What follows is a still perfectly up-to-date show we first ran in May of 2011. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week's show is devoted to data, which is being collected and crunched in breathtaking quantities at breakneck speed. According to The Economist, Walmart logs more than 2.5 petabytes of information about customer transactions every hour, equivalent to 167 times the books in the Library of Congress. News producers and news consumers love data. It's nonpartisan and predictable as arithmetic. But we've talked a lot on this show about data omitted or abused in medical journals, data stretched or muddled in political polls, baseless numbers bouncing like volleyballs from pundit to politician and back again. Data are so ubiquitous in media, we don't feel the need to belabor the point. Instead, we'll start by tying the data to you. On a recent New York evening, I attended a meetup of self-quantifiers, people who closely track a wide variety of their own behaviors or emotional and physical states at various points in the day or when engaged in activities ranging from cycling to sleeping or just living. That's what Sandy Santra does. He takes about 7,000 calls per year at his job at a computer help call desk. As he told the group,
I track yearly salary, blood pressure, migraines, time alone, happiness, meltdowns, that happens at work, panic attacks. I put new goals on a spreadsheet, and if I keep doing those push-ups every day, 21 days later, the goal turns from red to green. I'm there. I've made it a habit. What is all this? Data plus information compiled and organized turns into knowledge. It makes self-improvement inevitable. And I like that. Thank you.
Some of the young men and women, mostly men here, embrace self-quantification variously as a creed. Others pursue it as a hobby or a health plan, business opportunity, or art project. Lori Frick graphs the peaks and valleys of her sleep and turns them into art pieces that possess a soothing visual rhythm.
I mean, everybody thinks sleep holds secrets, right? It's this thing, you know, you go to bed at night, you wake up in the morning, what happened in between?
Do you know what happens in between?
I see exactly how many times I wake up during the night. I know how much I dreamt. I see how many minutes I spend in deep sleep. I see exactly in the morning what happened.
At this meetup, Lori showed her art. Sandy delivered his mission statement, and NYU student Matt Ganeshow talked about his school project, designed to redirect the attention of self-quantifiers outward. Basically, when someone enlisted in Ganeshow's project runs into another person in the project, he or she silently assesses the other's mood, according to a standard medical pain scale chart. But before doing that, that person must first assess his own mood.
So that creates two data points. You end up with a graph of how you perceive yourself to be versus how your community perceives yourself to be.
Ganeshow says that the very technology enabling us to escape into self-quantification cocoons also holds the potential to expand our self-absorption to larger and larger communities in a kind of feedback loop.
Because the more that I look at you and the more that I try to see, are you doing okay, the more information I am going to get back. And it may be a technology trick, but if we can actually have technology train us to look at each other again, then it doesn't become I'm monitoring my scale 100 days so I can lose weight and it's my bubble. It becomes, how are you doing with your progress? And then, how are they doing? And how are they doing? And then let's aggregate that together and say, how collectively are we doing?
MIT researcher Deb Roy talked about his project in a March TED Talk.
Imagine if you could record your life. Everything you said, everything you did, so you could go back and find memorable moments and relive them. Well, that's exactly the journey that my family began 5.5 years ago.
He described how he recorded 90,000 hours of video from every angle of his son's first years as he acquired language. And he offered an audio portrait akin to time-lapse photography of how, over the passage of time, the baby, then toddler, learned to say water.
He sure nailed it, didn't he?
Roy then shifted from his child's acquisition of language to a public online response to the president's State of the Union address, a light show of data points coalescing around words and ideas captured and quantified in all manner of electronic communication. He called it a real-time pulse of the nation activated by content.
The idea is this: as our world becomes increasingly instrumented and we have the capabilities to collect and connect the dots, it's like building a microscope or a telescope and revealing new structures about our own behavior around communication. And I think the implications here are profound, whether it's for science, for commerce, for government, but perhaps most of all, for us as individuals.
So, all those individual unique data points have the potential to reveal our society's workings. Good stuff. But amassing all that revelatory data demands that we all engage in staggering amounts of self-tracking. What does all that navel-gazing do to us? Gary Wolf, contributing editor of Wired and co-founder of The Quantified Self, a blog about, quote, self-knowledge through numbers, started this whole thing, so I pummeled him with my fears.
We hear a lot at The Quantified Self the worry that this is just the ultimate stage in a kind of narcissistic apocalypse, so that we will soon not notice anything that goes on more than a few inches from our own nose.
Well said.
I think that that is a fear without a foundation. And one of the things that happens when people begin to pay attention to themselves in new ways is that they see in a different light what they have in common with other people.
What keeps us optimistic is a sort of fantasy of who we are and what we might become. And don't we run the risk of losing hope when confronted with the harsh numerical reality of what we really are?
I think that's a very good question. There is a whole industry devoted to selling the possibility of change to people. For instance, health clubs, which see that huge uptick in membership after January 1st. And many, many things that we see in our consumer culture are based on hopes that never come true. And one of the things that happens in the quantified self is people begin to see how related all of their behaviors are and how difficult it is to change one thing in isolation and then at the same time how difficult it is to change many things at once. On the one hand, this is discouraging, whether it's weight loss or extreme improvements in happiness or great leaps of productivity. The promise of radical change is one of the things that we live on in our society. At the same time, I think trading fantasies of radical change for possibilities of small, important changes is a trade-off worth making.
You think it makes us smarter than our consumer culture?
I hope it does.
If you track yourself over a long period of time, you will inevitably quantify your own physical and cognitive decline, right?
Yes.
That's depressing.
We probably do need to tune up our capacity to handle that truth, especially as our demographic shift, at least in this country, towards an older population creates incentive to sell people fantasies that their cognitive decline is ultimately preventable rather than merely manageable. When you fail to see those clear, realistic limits, you're vulnerable to being exploited and you're vulnerable to terrible crashes. So I think the overall effect of this is very healthy, but not easy.
What do you think is the most powerful truth you learned about yourself from self-quantifying?
I track my exercise time and my work time, and I have a meditation practice that I track. And one of the things that became clear that was absolutely fascinating to me was that attempting to increase the quantity of good things that I did too much caused a complete rebound effect.
Really?
Oh, yes. The advice to go for it, you know, this is advice that is pretty common. And in my case, at least, it was really pernicious. And you could see really clearly that when, due to some influence or some ambition, I attempted to turn a steady habit of doing something up by a lot, a short period of increased activity, say increased physical exercise, and then zero on the chart for weeks.
I think I can duplicate your results.
I think it's more common than people realize. And, you know, this is really fascinating to think that really the advice for people who are trying to do something is do as little as you possibly can in the right direction and see what happens. And if that works, do another tiny little bit in that direction.
And only available through the quantified self approach.
It's not that you can't find suggestions about what to do. The value for many people in the quantified self is creating a feedback loop that's customized for them so that they can do something as simple as find out whether what they are trying to do is working at all, and even find out what it is that they're actually doing.
Gary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gary Wolf is co-founder of the blog The Quantified Self. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
Hey, everybody. I'm OTM producer Alex Goldman.
And I'm OTM producer PJ Vogt. So, Alex, why are we here in the middle of the podcast? You got some sort of announcement?
We're relaunching our long dormant On the Media newsletter.
Sounds like a threat.
People can sign up on the front page of our website. We'll use their email addresses in a non-spammy way.
I think what you mean to say is that if people sign up for the newsletter once a week, we'll send them really cool stuff. What's in the show, extra stuff that's not in the show.
Yeah, but if you say that, really cool stuff, it sounds like we're going to send them candy bars.
We're not going to send them candy bars. I mean, obviously a newsletter is super exciting, but this is public radio. Shouldn't we find some way to offer people mugs?
It's like you're reading my mind. For the next 4 weeks, we're going to be selecting at random, with no prejudice toward friends or family, four people who will win an On the Media, On Caffeine coffee mug.
Huh. So people should sign up for the newsletter. They can do it on the website?
Yes. The front page of the website, there's a little button at the top that says e-newsletter sign up.
Cool. And like us on iTunes.
Yeah, do that too.
All right. Awesome.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with the rebroadcast of our special data show. We proceed now from data tailored to the individual to data as a tool of public policy. The sad reality that data are often subverted by politics is summed up in that old cliche about lies, damned lies, and statistics. But that's certainly not always the case. There are wellsprings of reliable data that lead to good policy, and one of them is the nonprofit, nonpartisan news gathering website called the Texas Tribune, which bases its clear, cogent reporting on information gleaned from the state's databases. It also engages readers as citizens by offering them interactive access to raw data. Matt Stiles, who was a Texas Tribune reporter, says the site ranges far and wide across fertile fields of data.
We had a story that came out the other day, a traditional story, that said one of the agencies that was going to be cut severely was the Texas Forest Service, which backs up local and rural fire departments when they're dealing with these massive fires. So I went back and pulled data for several years showing which fires they had worked and how many homes had been destroyed, and just did a thematic map with symbols on it that showed the size of the fire and the number of fires. You can bet that lawmakers looked at that map and thought about their districts and what that might mean. Almost weekly, we push out a new map or a new interactive of some sort. We have a database of 160,000 prisoners so that the public can come, and if they happen to know a prisoner, they can search. But they also see all kinds of views and visualization of the data so that they can understand where prisoners are, what the most common crimes are. We have a database of 700,000 public employees from all types of government agencies in Texas, a database of all lobbying activity over the last couple of years. We're developing a census app now.
Is there any information that you've wanted but you just haven't been able to get your hands on?
We've had a lot of luck getting what we want. There are some hurdles left, though. State officials in Texas don't have to file their personal financial disclosure forms in an electronic format. So if we request them, we get a bunch of PDF files or essentially paper files that can't be searched necessarily. We'd love to be able to pull that data down and slice and dice it and make some connections about lawmakers and their finances.
Do you think that Texas is better than many states when it comes to releasing data?
I do. I think there's something in the political culture in Texas. It's a conservative state, and conservatives like government transparency. And so when you go to an elected official and ask them for information, it's just more difficult, I think, for them to deny your request. In Texas, you can get an applause line from a crowd by saying you want to increase government transparency. I don't know if it's like that everywhere else.
Matt, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Matt Stiles is now the database reporting coordinator for NPR's State Impact Project. Sarah Cohen is a Knight Professor of the Practice of Journalism and Public Policy at Duke University and an expert in computer-assisted investigative reporting. She wishes that the federal government were as keen as Texas to share relevant data. But she says President Obama's promises of transparency, starting with his Open Government Initiative, haven't delivered the goods.
The Open Government Initiative was really never much about accountability and transparency. It was about getting information that the government wanted you to have in entrepreneurs' hands so they can build iPhone apps and things like that. That doesn't really help us hold government accountable. It doesn't help us report stories.
They're more responsive to FOIA requests, aren't they?
Sometimes.
And they've launched a website called data.gov.
Yeah, that's a case where there's not really much on there that was never available if you went looking for it. And that's what I kind of mean, is this idea of putting what the government wants you to already have in one centralized place. It's got car seat ratings and things like that on it, but you won't find many spending records there, and you're not going to find very many inspection records there, and you're probably not going to find records of who's been prosecuted on that site.
So, Sarah, what would make you happy?
What would make me happy would be to get access to the actual records that are used in government. We're still not getting access to things like secretaries' actual calendars rather than the public calendars. We're not getting access to congressional correspondence. The things that go on within an agency that are done with our money and in our name. And I know a lot of other people are really interested in this idea of an information floor, that every agency should have certain things that they give out to everybody, how they spend their money, for instance. Spending records, those are a little bit better, but you can't get behind any of them to get to the actual contracts and grants.
What do you think of the success of an outlet like the nonprofit website, the Texas Tribune? Do you see this as the beginning of a trend of making available information meaningful?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Texas Tribune is probably among the best examples of really good work being done through data journalism, really putting together records from government that were difficult to get and now are easy for the public to get. But I think there are a lot of stories that go undone because these records aren't available. As an example, there's a reporter in Texas who's been trying to look into payments by the Federal Marshals Service there and has never been able to get his FOIAs answered. There's a lot of information that is still being kept secret. So I think there is a flood of data, but I'm not entirely sure that there's a flood of records and information behind it.
Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sarah Cohen teaches at Duke University. Both she and Matt Stiles believe in the power of data. They only wish it were more abundant and more relevant. But data can be dangerous, even deadly, as OTM producer Jamie York reports in these two cautionary tales.
Tale number one. There are a few more obvious indicators of urban blight than fires. Burned out buildings and empty lots announce devastation and neglect. By the 1970s, New York City announced that it was going broke Its residents were fleeing to the suburbs, and it was very clearly on fire.
The fire statistics for New York are staggering. New York has more fires than Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, and Philadelphia put together.
Firemen call this decade and a half the war years, but the devastation was confined to poor neighborhoods, and most New Yorkers had no idea what was happening in their own city. That is until 1977. Joe Flood is author of The Fires.
So it was the second game of the 1977 World Series. Los Angeles Dodgers, New York Yankees, Bronx, New York. About 60 million people watching at home. And before the game, a fire breaks out in an abandoned area of the Bronx. By the end of the 70s, this particular neighborhood had lost over 99% of its buildings to fire and abandonment. On this night, a fire broke out in what turned out to be an abandoned schoolhouse. And throughout the game, they cut to it. Famously, Howard Cosell intones to the tens of millions of people at home, "There it is, ladies and gentlemen, the Bronx is burning." Turns out he actually never said this.
That is a live picture, and obviously the fire department in the Bronx have their...
Nevertheless, it marks the moment America first becomes aware that this wasn't just about a few buildings burning in the Bronx.
They see what surrounds it, which is block after block of burned out and abandoned buildings, abandoned lots strewn with rubble, and this becomes a tale of decay, of the crumbling inner city.
Dennis Smith wrote the definitive book of the war years called Report from Engine Company 82. As a young firefighter in the late 1960s, he sought out the busiest firehouse in the city, Company 82 in the South Bronx.
You could look out and see the next job that you were going to go to because the smoke and the fire was already coming out of the windows. I mean, we went from one fire to the next. An average of about 40 alarms a day.
So why was the Bronx burning? Many of the buildings in poor neighborhoods had been built in the early 20th century. They were old, unsafe, and overcrowded. When the landlord, say, cut back on heating oil, people used space heaters, which either overtaxed the wiring or actually set something ablaze. If a few apartments were burned out, maintaining the rest of the building wasn't a priority. Junkies set up shooting galleries in the abandoned spaces. Where once a fire would lead to increased vigilance by neighbors, it was suddenly the opposite. Fire became an indicator of more fire. And then in the late 1960s, New York City made a fateful choice and hired the RAND Corporation to give advice to the fire department about how best to allocate its resources. RAND was the original military think tank. It has its roots in World War II, when the Air Force recruited a stable of intellectuals who created systems analysis, a clear, exacting way of exposing inefficiencies and reducing the messiness of war to tables, charts, and spreadsheets. And it worked. Fresh off their success in World War II, this group of whiz kids created the RAND Corporation. And by the late 1950s, RAND's approach, apolitical, data-driven, was revolutionizing business and public policy. Joe Flood.
Technology creates the nuclear bomb that leads to America's victory in Japan, that leads to its international dominance geopolitically. In the early 1960s, the White House's economists, year after year, were coming within 0.2% accuracy of predicting the employment rate, of predicting inflation, of predicting gross domestic product. The world seemed to be a predictable place, a place that could be understood and solved by numbers.
New York City had a progressive mayor and a highly innovative fire chief, both of whom were enthralled to the idea of data-driven solutions to their management and fire woes. The only problem? RAND knew nothing about fighting fires. So they did what they usually did. They broke the problem into manageable parts. First up, how long does it take a fire engine to get to a fire?
What they do is they give stopwatches to about a dozen fire companies. A dozen stopwatches for around 300 total fire companies. So margin of error is already going to be a problem.
Another problem? The system relies on firemen to operate the stopwatches on the way to a fire. Needless to say, participation is a little spotty. What's more, Joe Flood says, RAND fails to accurately figure traffic into its model, estimating response time as the same at rush hour in Midtown and a residential neighborhood at 4 a.m. Most importantly, according to Joe Flood, RAND assumed that firemen respond from their firehouses. But when you can see the next fire you're going to be fighting, you might not get back to your firehouse for hours. To compensate, the busiest firehouses had what they called a second section, a backup company.
But the models saw these backups as redundancies and recommended that they be closed in the most fire-prone neighborhoods.
When these second sections are closed, you see the number of fires that the first company that's left behind as much as quadruple within a couple of years. When you're able to respond to a fire inside of a few minutes, you can often prevent it from spreading. So what is a serious problem becomes something of an epidemic of fire in a lot of these neighborhoods, and it feeds and grows on itself as this continues.
Empty buildings, like Dresden.
Firefighter Dennis Smith.
In a report from Energy Company 82, I said there's a Dresdenization of this neighborhood. All you see are these empty windows. They're like hollow eyes that are coming out of these buildings, thousands of them. And they serve no purpose except to remind you of the utter destruction of the neighborhood.
It was a striking case of bad data having the worst kind of real-world consequence. Rand denies many of these errors in judgment, but Joe Flood stands by his analysis. He does not doubt that the people involved were guided by the best of intentions, that is, to solve problems. But the data are seductive. They may seem to be solutions, but they all too often create more problems. Cautionary tale number two. Ed Thorpe was a math whiz, a professor at MIT who in the 1960s became the first person to go to Vegas and beat the house at blackjack. This was probability theory, or put another way, counting cards. Thorpe called his 1962 book Beat the Dealer, and it inspired a whole generation of math geeks to apply math to gambling. But Thorpe was already off to his next challenge.
He quickly alighted upon Wall Street. He looked at all sorts of investing strategies and came upon some fairly complex stuff in the convertible bond world. Ed went to work on it. He got his IBM supercomputers out. He fed in reams of data, and he learned that there were a lot of anomalies in this, at the time, very obscure corner of Wall Street. He quickly started making money.
Michael Lewis was a more traditional trader on Wall Street who watched the game change. He went on to write Liar's Poker, an account of the street in the mid-1980s.
In a matter of a few years, it was overrun by people who had PhDs in physics and math from MIT. And there was a sort of general view that managing risk was complicated, so complicated the ordinary mortal couldn't understand it.
The quant's most elemental strategy, Patterson says, was to use the immense amounts of data from the past to predict the future. Patterson says that the strangest illustration of this comes from the most successful quant group, a fund named Medallion, which is and has been staffed with voice recognition experts from IBM.
The idea is to predict with some probability what the most likely next syllable or word may be based on historical patterns. So if it detects a phrase from the Star Spangled Banner or something, it has a high probability of predicting what the next word is going to be.
This capability applied to finance was something like magic, alchemy. The model seemed to have found a way to identify anomalies in the market and perfectly predict the potential losses of any gamble. But it insulated them to the very real unpredictability of life. And the quants didn't just snow investors. The complexity of what they'd created befuddled their managers and ultimately the quants themselves.
The models told the bosses that, this was actually what they were doing was riskless.
Michael Lewis.
The models were wrong. The important point about them was they all lost their money alongside everybody else. They believed what they were doing. What the complexity has done is make the risk opaque. In this era of Wall Street, complexity is the new opacity. It's what prevents most people from exercising their judgment when presented with financial risk, because they're just persuaded they don't understand it. It's all too complicated.
When Wall Street imploded, first in the so-called quant quake of 2007, and then in plain sight in 2008, the quants lost a tremendous amount of money, mostly other people's, and they were chastened, but only a little.
Now we have this new investing strategy, or I don't really know what you would call it, called high-frequency trading, which is estimated to account for upwards of 70 to 80% of the U.S. stock market.
Scott Patterson.
And it's completely computer-driven. These firms are pushing the limits of technological computer speed. It boggles your mind. They're measuring their trades, the speed which they can send an order to an exchange at microseconds, which is a billionth of a second. And now they're talking about picoseconds, Is that a trillionth of a second or something?
Then on May 6, 2010, an event now widely known as the flash crash.
You have seen a flight to safety within gold.
This market is dropping precipitously. It just went negative 500.
Markets coping with continued fear over failure.
The stock market fell about 10% in the space of just a few minutes. And we now know that it was almost completely the result of computers reacting to instability in the news and panicking.
And we saw crazy things happen. We saw the order books for our national stock markets vanished. The order book is where all the trades take place at these data centers, most of which are in New Jersey. We saw exchange-traded funds that are representing billions of dollars of shareholder value trade for a penny. So it was a complete break in the market structure, because when the market is falling rapidly, that's when you need market makers to step in and create order. That's what the specialist on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange job has been for decades. But now, because of the proliferation of secret computer strategies, you have a market that is completely blind to itself.
Data is always susceptible to our very human, very analog limitations. In New York City, it was the well-intentioned desire to find clarity in a city of immense complexity, an earnest desire to help solve a problem. On Wall Street, it was almost completely the opposite. The data allowed smart people to make a lot of money, even as it blinded them to how much risk was involved. There's a pattern here, Joe Flood says. Initially, we use data as a way to think hard about difficult problems. But then we over-rely on data as a way to avoid thinking hard about difficult problems. We surrender our better judgment and leave it to the algorithm. Right now, computers are flitting through unprecedented stores of information, systems that undergird so much of our lives, looking for answers and hidden patterns. It's much too late to stand in the way of that process. Maybe Warren Buffett was right when he said, "Beware of geeks bearing formulas." For On the Media, I'm Jamie York.
Coming up, Radiolab's Jad Abumrad raises the question,
how do we know that the facts that are here today will be there tomorrow?
Some scientific findings that put even the possibility of certainty in doubt. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone, bringing you this very special hour on data. How am I doing? Former New York Mayor Ed Koch used to ask passersby, "How am I doing?" assembling data points from a manifestly insufficient survey. In the last segment, you heard how difficult it can be to determine which data point, what study parameter is vital, and which irrelevant or worse.
Yo, it's e to the power 6 division sign, L minus 9, put a bracket on the side, SX multiplied by EFX of 5V times 3, and it wouldn't equal sign. What's the answer? Go BZ369.
None of this is intended to imply that we should reject data. Matt Stiles of the Texas Tribune showed us how good data can lead to smart policy. I believe that the scientific process, with its reproducible results and the insights they provide, offers us the best chance for progress. But science is never pure, never complete, and so it would seem wise to season the data with cultural contexts and values. I feel uneasy even mentioning those things, knowing full well their potential to muddy the waters. But Jamie's piece illustrated how data, impenetrably derived and applied by WizKids, made dangerous situations worse in the Bronx and on Wall Street. Often, we are blinded by science, so deep skepticism is warranted.
Do the math.
How much skepticism is enough? We conclude this hour with a piece that I am told will attempt to answer that question in a way that just might rock your world. We're joined now by Jad Abumrad, host and producer of Radiolab.
Hey, Brooke.
Who's brought us a piece that he did involved with data. And that's pretty much all I know.
So we knew you guys were doing a show on data, which apparently has something to do with the media, but who knows what it is. But data is this, first of all, it's a great word. It's a word that when you say, you feel rooted to the earth. more strongly than you did before. Because it's a word that means truth, right?
How do we know that what we think are facts are, in fact, facts?
And the question that this piece asks in a way is, how do we know that the facts that are here today will be there tomorrow?
Can you set it up?
Sure. Well, this is a story that Robert and I bumped into.
Robert Krolwich?
That's right. Robert Krolwich, my co-host. It just kind of spooked us a little bit. It begins with a guy named Jonathan Schooler, who is a psychologist, who back in the 80s did this study that everybody was just falling over themselves about. He had people watch a video of a bank robbery.
They basically watch this bank robber walk into a bank, and he hands a note to the clerk, and he says, "Don't press the alarm and you won't get hurt." Clerk then hands him some money, and he exits.
Now, during this whole video, you see the bank robber just fine.
You get a straight-on look at the bank robber, absolutely.
And here was the test. After everybody watched this thing, he had half the subjects
write down in as much detail for 5 minutes everything they could remember about the appearance of the bank robber.
Just to kind of help them remember. And later, he had everybody, all the subjects, try and pick the guy out of a police lineup. Now, you would expect that the half of them that had to describe the guy right after seeing the video, that they would do really well at this.
Because they'd already verbalized his physical characteristics.
Set the memory, in a sense. But in fact, what happened was the opposite.
We found those people who had been asked to describe the face in great detail, they were actually less good at recognizing the face than if they didn't engage in any description at all.
And not just a little less good. They were like 30 or 40% less good.
So it was pretty whopping.
That's amazing. And I remember this now. You guys at Radiolab did a big thing on this.
Yeah, we did a big thing. Malcolm Gladwell did a big thing. The New York Times probably did a big thing. It was a big study. It was one of these things you were like, at dinner, you were like, oh my God. You would never believe what I heard on the radio, this amazing thing.
Yeah, it got some press at the time, and it really was sort of a launch pad for a whole set of different studies.
Not to mention that it kind of made Jonathan Schooler a little bit of a rock star, you know, so to speak. And this is where our story really begins, because just as he was making it into all these Psych 101 textbooks, his data started to do some funny things, and it all began when he tried to replicate that original experiment.
That's right.
Well, as you kept doing it, what happened?
Well, over the years, over the next 5 or 6 years, when I attempted to do it again, I would get the effect, but not to the same degree that I did initially.
And this is a little troubling for him.
That's Joan Allaire, science writer, one of our contributing editors, who's written a lot about Schooler. And he says it went like this. The first time Schooler tries to replicate that study, that effect
falls by 30%.
And so he tried it again and again.
And as we kept trying to replicate this study, the effect size got smaller and smaller and smaller.
Meaning that big difference between the people who wrote about the bank robber and got it wrong and people who didn't write about the bank robber and they got it right, that big difference began to decline.
This slow downward trajectory.
It did sort of gradually get smaller. It wasn't as if all of a sudden it disappeared.
Now it's still significant. It's still publishable, but it's not nearly as exciting as it was that first time.
So Jonathan Schooler's sitting in his office and he's thinking, what's going on? Like, how come this research started out with such thunder and then faded? And the first theory that he really has to grapple with
is something known as regression to the mean.
I mean, those are three of the most uninspired words put together.
Yeah. They're four words, though. It's regression to the mean.
But Jonah, can you make it concrete for us?
Sure. So you flip a coin, right? Let's say you'll flip a coin 10 times. You may get 8 heads and 2 tails. And you may say, oh my gosh, I've discovered a new law of coin flipping. When I flip coins in this room, they are almost always heads.
But as we all know,
if you kept on flipping that coin for, say, 1,000 times, your data would show almost certainly, unless you really had discovered something very peculiar about that room, the results would get closer to the true result, which is about 50%.
The results would regress to the mean. And so Jonathan's first thought was maybe that's what was happening here.
Yeah.
Meaning?
When we first did the study, for whatever reason, we got lucky or unlucky, as the case may be.
You saw an outlier.
Exactly.
That reality is full of quirky surprises we can't explain. But over time, and this is the miracle of the scientific process, you regress to the true effect size.
But one thing about the regression to the mean account is it doesn't really explain why the effects gradually get smaller. Regression to the mean, you predict one big effect, and then it should basically totter around the actual value. This gradual decline doesn't naturally fall out of the regression to the mean account.
Yeah, I mean, the effect could just go away, in which case you knew you were wrong. But why would it slowly get worse?
Well, one possible explanation is that there was some aspect to the procedure that was important that we never really realized was important, and somehow we were gradually not including whatever that secret ingredient was.
It could have been the color of the room in which he was conducting the experiments. It could have been how charming his grad student was, who was actually asking the students to describe the bank robber. Totally making up a story here. Mm-hmm. Let's say that grad student was so charming, so good-looking, so charismatic that he distracted the students. Then the grad student goes off, leaves the lab. Now he's got a much less exciting grad student. It's not nearly as distracting. And now the effect size of verbal overshadowing has gone down.
Interesting.
The only problem with that is that little sound that Jed and I made, means that you have to have your charming grad student at the beginning and your less charming grad student in the middle and your even less charming grad student on
your back. Yeah, they have to get slowly less charming.
That's right.
And so if you're thinking something is changing here, what is it? What is it? What is it? Did you go on some kind of mad search to figure out what you might be doing differently?
We tried a lot of different things, and in the end, I just moved to another area of research.
You got out of town.
And apparently, one of Schooler's colleagues told him,
"Don't worry about it. The only mistake you made was trying to replicate it in the first place."
But here's the problem.
Turns out, it's not just me who has experienced this peculiar decline effect.
As he started to look around, he realized what was happening to him was happening all over the place.
In biology, there was a meta-analysis of many different biological findings showing...
There are a ton of examples, he says, and here's one that he gave us. In the 90s, there were a bunch of studies about animals using symmetry to find mates, like birds.
Females.
Female birds choosing their sexual partners based on how even their tail feathers were.
It was a very exciting idea. And the first year, there were 8 tests of it. And all 8 found that, yep, fluctuating asymmetry, that's what the phenomenon is called, is real. We also got an effect size.
So it seemed true.
Yeah, that all over the world and all these different species, females had evolved this unconscious tendency to prefer symmetrical males. The next year, it's tested 12 times, and 9 of the 12 confirm it. And then things start to fall apart. You can make the sound effect. Yeah, exactly. Until by the end of the 90s, you're going 1 for 13.
One for 13?
Now, of course, these studies are not black and white yes-no studies. There's some gradation. But this was the basic trend that Jonah saw.
And just in case birds seem a little distant, here's another example.
And I think this is, for me, the most troubling area of the decline effect. Because you see like second-generation antipsychotics.
Second-generation antipsychotics.
These are drugs used to treat people with schizophrenia, bipolar. Mm-hmm. When they first came out in the late 80s, early 90s, some studies found that they were about twice as effective than first-generation antipsychotics. And then what happened is the standard story of the decline effect, cue the sound effect, which is clinical trial after clinical trial, the effect size just slowly started to fall apart. You see a similar decline with things like Prozac and really? Antidepressants.
Really? Wow.
The effect of the drugs have gotten weaker, but the placebo effect has also gotten stronger. I was talking to one guy at a drug company who – he was kind of interesting. He blamed that on drug advertising. He said that they started to see their placebo effect go up in the late 90s when these drug companies started advertising.
But then wouldn't that actually offer an explanation for this decline thing? Because – you know, if you know about what this drug is supposed to do, maybe it works differently somehow?
Certainly there are areas of psychology where that can change the outcome in one way or another. Mm. But it's very unlikely that, you know, in say these female preferences for symmetrical feathers that the birds got wind of this symmetry finding and now all of a sudden are not into it anymore.
I don't know.
You haven't been around chickadee conversation lately.
Word passes quickly amongst the chickadees.
Can you explain why what you found at the beginning is not what you find now?
And why it gradually went away. The gradually is still puzzling.
I tell you, I'm personally baffled.
It's tough to come up with an all-purpose explanation or some easy fix.
Could be a lot of things, says Jonah. I mean, in some cases, it might be statistics.
Regression to the mean is almost sure to be a part of it.
Or maybe it's, you know.
There could be this gradual change in the procedure and something that we just don't know what it was that happened.
Can't rule it out.
But I would probably be less shocked than most people if something unconventional was actually involved in this as well.
Unconventional, like?
Like, I say this with some trepidation, but I think we can't rule out the possibility that there could be some way in which the act of observation is actually changing the nature of reality. That somehow, in the process of observing effects, we change the nature of those effects.
Oh, you're in real trouble.
But it sounds like you're saying that maybe the truth is running away from you or something?
Well, I'm not going to say that. I'm certainly not going to say that there's some sort of intentionality to these effects disappearing. More that it's almost, and again, this is just speculation, some sort of habituation. So just as when you put your hand on your leg, you feel it, and then as you leave it there, it becomes less and less noticeable. Somehow there may be some kind of habituation that happens in with respect to these findings.
But what is the hand and what is the leg in this?
Well, in this most radical conjecture, there could be some sort of collective consciousness that's habituating. Again, radical speculation, but there may be some peculiar way about the nature of reality that somehow it gets into the ether. Huh. Keep in mind, the notion that the laws of reality are unchangeable is an assumption. It's a reasonable assumption, but we don't know it for a fact. And there have been physicists who have even speculated that perhaps the rules change as time goes on.
But by this logic, you could never actually know anything for sure.
Because reality could change based upon the observer's position, habits, biases, information, whatever.
Well, so far, we have not really seen these types of things in the domain of physics. But, you know, an aspirin might not do what it used to. Huh. There's a question that you haven't asked, which is, let's say that we were to do a study and demonstrate this decline effect, that when you keep running experiments, that they get smaller. Well, what happens when you try to replicate that effect? Does the decline effect decline?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Maybe we could just get rid of the decline effect by studying it.
Where does that leave certainty?
Well, first of all, it doesn't happen everywhere, this effect that we're talking about. Gravity, you know, Newton's laws, all that stuff seems to be constant. But it does seem to happen in places where there are a lot of variables at play. Science, of course, as you know, is this thing where you try and isolate everything except one thing, and you change that one thing, and you study the effect that one change has. So this may be an indication that you're not isolating that one thing, that there are many causes that you're not aware of, and that we're not measuring what we think we're measuring. I kind of like his theory, though. Me being a person who likes to believe in magic, I sort of go with his fun.
I just don't understand how the human ether is going to affect the sexual preferences of birds.
The birds perhaps have their own collective unconscious, which commingles with ours in the ether, where the radio waves go, you know, and the spirits reside. So it could be up there somewhere.
Do you think you contributed, Jad, personally, to this disturbance in the ether by making such a big deal of this finding?
I think we did, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the media is biased. Maybe not in the way that people think it is, but it's certainly biased towards tension. It's biased towards surprise. And so there might be some kind of bias that leads us all towards a result that is counterintuitive and exciting. You know?
Yeah, but I mean, it's not as if you didn't do due diligence.
No, we did.
Or that Dr. Schooler didn't do due diligence.
That's
how
what's weird.
Many times do you have to perform a study?
That's a really good question. I mean, the lesson that I draw from all this is that in certain places, like in that whole school of psychology studies about people doing things that seem really counterintuitive and that are really fun to talk about, you know what I'm talking about. You can smell them in the air, like that kind of study. You just have to think to yourself, wait a second, is it really that simple? And it may be something spooky in the universe, or it may be that the scientific process is in some sense, undermined by all the things we don't even know we don't know about. But it's just really hard. We just have to be careful.
The bottom drops out of your show if you can't quote a study because it hasn't been reproduced 500 times.
Well, that just means we're going to be a sports show, which has been my secret desire all along.
And our program leaves people with the message we love to leave people with. Trust no one. Thanks again, Chad.
Of course, thank you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sarah Abdorrahman, and edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, with help this week from Dylan Keefe. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will most definitely be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.